The views and opinions expressed on the following program are not necessarily those of the staff and management of KLAY or those who advertise their products or services on this station.
Hello again. Welcome to Ask an Atheist, a weekly education call-in program dedicated to atheism, skeptical inquiry, and the separation of church and state. I'm your host today, Sam Mulvey, and joining me this week again are, and again I did it, joining me this week again are Mike Gillis. Hey, how's it going? And new to the this side of the microphone, but not new to Ask an Atheist, is Rich Lyons. How are you doing today?
Awesome. Glad to be here.
All right. We should get right down to it.
Yes. As you may know, we have an ongoing segment on this show we like to call Countdown to Backpedaling, where we watch the clock tick down to Family Radio's torturous rationalizations and excuse-making. As you might know, Family Radio is a Christian fundamentalist organization that's putting these billboards up all over the country. I think some in Puerto Rico as well.
Yeah, that was a new one.
Well, the important thing to know about these billboards is that they are telling us that on May 21st, Jesus is going to return and usher in the end times. I don't think any of us actually think this is going to happen. I mean, show of hands, I mean, Sam, Rich,
I'm totally not down with that.
Reasonably certain nobody in this room.
I think it's a fair bet. We're not going to put any money down on Family Radio on this one.
No, but if they want to put down money,
they'd be happy to. I mean, if they really think the world is going to end starting on May 21st,
right,
I welcome them to give me their house. But we don't know what they're going to do. We don't know if they're going to tell us that Jesus never came back, and that we did something to scare him away, that he doesn't want to come out of his room because we were naughty in some way. We don't know if they're going to make an excuse and say that he did come back, but he left.
And we missed it.
We missed it. Oh. Where were you guys? What happened? He came back. Blink of an eye, he's gone. He's like Kaiser Soze.
Didn't the backpedaling in some way already begin recently? You were telling me about this.
Yeah, I was talking to Jeremy about this, and he was saying that they were already laying the groundwork for even if we're wrong, we're still right.
Right.
And we don't know what they're going to do. And I think that one of the big important parts of Countdown to Backpedaling is that we basically keep people, you know, we don't let them forget that these guys are doing this. These guys are part of a long tradition of people announcing the end of the world. Mm-hmm. What we're going to do is keep, I guess, I wouldn't say keep hope alive, but definitely keep mockery alive until May 21st. And then when we get to May 22nd, we're going to see how
Party.
They're going to react. Yes. we want to see how they're going to react. And that's why we call it Countdown to Backpedaling. We're not sure what we're going to get, but we're reasonably sure it's not going to be Jesus.
Indeed. Are you familiar with specific predictions about the end of the world?
Yeah, I am. And as a former preacher, I always hung my hat on the verse that says, "No man knows the day or the hour." So whenever I had a specific prediction, mine was, okay, we know that's not it. Mm. So that was the way I always handled that.
One of the websites that we have for our show is wecantknow.com. And I've been following sort of the metrics we get from linkbacks and referrers. And one of my favorite links that we've gotten is the Jehovah Witnesses Forum for current and former Jehovah's Witnesses. And in there, wow, look, it's another countdown to the end of the world where Jesus is going to return. We're familiar with that, guys, aren't we?
Oh.
And once again, this is a call-in show, so if you would like to discuss this or anything else with us, atheism-related, you can call us at 253-584-1480.
Quite a week.
Indeed.
We actually do have some listener emails.
We do have some listener emails. This is something we do, is if you don't feel like calling us or you're not listening to us live, you can go to our website at askanatheist.tv and click the big, red, shiny, candy-like button, and you will be whisked to a form in which you can contact us. And our first email comes from Raphael from the internet, and here we go. I have a minor question about agnosticism that I hope you guys can answer. Are agnostics, in generally, agnostic about all gods? For example, I am certainly agnostic to a deist definition of a god, But if there is a testable claim about God, let's say that it flooded the earth around 6,000 years ago for 40 days and 40 nights, then I'm certainly Gnostic because that is something which we can investigate. Cheers.
Well, I think the thing that I get is, I generally speaking, agnostics are agnostic about all gods.
Right.
I mean, obviously, there's the god that you're the most familiar with because that's sort of the culturally dominant one. But I think that I have just as much doubt about the existence of Aslan or Krishna or Xenu or any number of other deities or demi-deities that are worshipped around the world, not just the ones that I'm culturally familiar with. As far as those other ones, I think that I also have a doubt. I mean, these are our testable claims about whether the earth was flooded, when it was flooded. Obviously, this is something that's going to be written about.
Right.
It's not like this is going to be skipped. It's like, oh, by the way, last week, this is such and such tact forms being collected in such and such region about 4,000 years ago. And oh, by the way, there was a giant flood. It's not like you see this point in time where all civilization on earth just dies out and then slowly grows back. There isn't this cataclysmic event. That is testable.
Right.
But that's a claim about a certain god, not necessarily about the existence of that god.
Right. Well, like we said last week, to us, we are atheists, but, well, we are atheism. But most of us are also agnostic atheists, where atheism is a statement of action and belief.
Right.
And agnosticism is a statement of knowledge. And this is something we get quite a bit as atheists, is I'll be at a bar, and somebody will say, well, you know, if somebody actually had testable proof of God, you still wouldn't believe. And I'd say, no.
That's a projection, too, that the only people that I know of that actually will specifically say that nothing will convince them to change their mind are generally religious people.
Right.
I've never met a lot of atheists. I mean, there have been some. We've gotten some cranks that have emailed us in the past who will basically detach themselves from an evidence-based argument, but for me, for my dollar, that's really the only kind of argument that matters. Can you prove the things that you believe? I care about whether the things I believe are true or not. And evidence is a way that I make that confirmation, not wishful thinking. I saw a quote recently, I forget who it was by, that simply said, we cannot make facts. Facts simply are. We can accept them or deny them, and they have to be the bedrock of what we believe. But we can't make a fact.
We can actually make a fact. If I pick up a glass of water, the fact that I picked up that glass of water becomes a fact. But it's actions which define facts, not beliefs.
Oh, absolutely. You can't will something into existence.
Right. Absolutely.
And then, you know, most of the agnostics that we encounter are atheist agnostics.
I would make the argument, too, and I've made this argument before, that any sane, rational, honest person is an agnostic, including religious believers.
Absolutely. We're all agnostic. Nobody can know. The fact that the religious person says it's based on faith, if they say, I know, then they're throwing faith out.
Absolutely. Those two concepts really are contradictory to one another. That faith is essentially the point where you don't know, but you're asserting that you do, despite the fact you don't have a trail of evidence. There's no chain of evidence between the thing you believe and why you believe it.
The only evidence for a sort of a Gnostic agnostic, or a theist agnostic that I've ever seen was from the film The Mummy, where one of the characters had all the religious symbols, and he was looking for the holy symbol that would make the mummy go away. He would just sort of flip through them as needed. And that's – I kind of wonder. So if you find yourself as a theist agnostic, again, give us a call. We are Ask an Atheist, 253-584-1480. And our next email comes from Steve Kritis, again from the internet. And he says, what do I say or do when someone of faith says that they have personally spoken with God? This one always stumps me. I want to say, no, you haven't. You're schizophrenic. But I don't. Oh, I'm sorry. He's not from the internet. He's from Buffalo, New York. I'm going to toss this
via
one
via the internet.
Via the internet, of course. I'm going to toss this one to Rich first. How do you address that?
I was one who had personally spoken with God many, many times. And after 20 years of that, suddenly realized that in the whole essence of that time, I never really actually heard anything other than what my gut told me. It was all gut feeling. And that's what you go with, because that's all you've got. There is no God speaking to you. And what do you tell someone who thinks they actually hear from God? When you what I like to do is kind of boil it down, say, okay, we're basically on a speck circling a really not so interesting star, not even in an exciting part of the solar system, in a galaxy. I mean, you look at the whole enormity of it all, and you think, number one, that there's a being capable of creating all of that, and he really cares enough to talk to you individually. I mean, you're really arrogant enough to believe that that incredibly powerful and capable being is going to take time out of his day to speak to you. And most likely what he's going to speak to you about is telling the person, usually the person saying, God spoke to me about this. They're usually going to tell you something they don't like about you or something you're doing that you shouldn't, and often involving your genitals. I mean, yeah. Really think that that magnificent creator cares at all about that. I mean, it's arrogant.
It's a supernatural don't shoot the messenger. I'm not saying this. God is saying this.
Exactly.
So don't get mad at me that I'm about to say something you don't like.
Exactly. That was one of the greatest cop-outs that we could use to say, God says, and that absolves you of all responsibility of what you're about to say after that. And it removes the ability to argue with it, because then at that point you're arguing with God, and you can't do that. It's the greatest preacher cop-out ever.
Yeah, I can't disagree with anything Rich said. I think that what it really comes down to is I would say to their friend that they're talking to themselves. Either that what I believe is happening, I don't doubt that they had this experience, that they felt something. I think they misinterpreted that experience.
Okay.
I think that, like I said about Dumbo's magic feather, that Dumbo was always capable of flying, but he gave the credit to something innately him to an outside source. And in this case, somebody's doing that with their own natural intuition. Like Rich said, they're hearing that their gut is talking to them there.
Right.
And honestly, it's usually that point where human beings have a moral quandary of some kind, and there's a part of your brain that's going one way, and then there's your emotions which are going in another way. And those things will fight each other, and I think I could easily understand someone interpreting that overriding sense of, you know this is bad for you, why are you doing this? Whether that comes from your upbringing or it comes from your natural experiences, your evolving moral compass, I could see them calling that God when I think it's in fact all entirely happening in their head. There's also the possibility they are schizophrenic.
That is something. Is there's a statistical possibility that some of these people who say they speak to God on a regular basis are in fact suffering from some mental issue. However, the statistics again say that most of these people are not.
Yeah.
And what they're experiencing is what you're describing, is it's an internal process which they are then externalizing and placing on an external deity when it's really coming from their own heads.
There's one thing that I think that religion does do. I think that in a weird sort of way, it obscures actual mental illness in some ways. That if somebody's mental illness, if their hallucinations, if the voices they hear match up well with a mainstream accepted religious deity, it becomes something where it may not seem as crazy as somebody who says aliens are talking to me.
Right.
And it could be that we don't investigate this as a mental illness until it actually becomes dangerous, maybe even after the fact, that if the voices in somebody's head sound like something that a well-known religious figure may say, like, oh, God is really, really angry because where people are having abortions or, you know, same-sex couples are marrying, versus the aliens in my head start telling me to murder my neighbors.
This is practically a trope of atheism. We talk about it so much that this is something that we're known for, is describing early parts of mental illness, the expression of mental illness, as being accidentally described as religious ecstasy or religious exegesis.
The part that scares me is that at those early stages, when somebody's just, oh, I think I talked to God last night, there's really no way to tell if somebody's actually crazy or not. Chances are they're not. Like
right.
You said, that most of these people are not statistically crazy. But what if they are? You know, and you don't know. I don't like the idea of something like that coming to fruition. And I would say, as far as, was it... what was the name of the person on that?
Oh, this would be Steve from Buffalo. Yeah.
Steve from Buffalo. I would tell Steve, put the burden of proof back on your friend and ask him, one, why do they believe that they were speaking to God, and what evidence can they provide? And if they really just give you some sort of subjective first-person account, which these things almost always are, then I would say, as Christopher Hitchens said, something presented without evidence can be dismissed without evidence.
Right.
Because these sort of experiences happen all over the world, and they just always seem to match up with what somebody's overriding cultural I guess zeitgeist would be. Like a Catholic who has a near-death experience or talks to God always seems to have an experience that matches up with the religion they already hold. The same thing with a Hindu or a Buddhist.
Right. I suppose one way to figure out if this is mental illness or something else is to figure out what medium their God chooses to communicate to them through.
Oh, is this like the barking dog with Son of Sam?
Exactly. If it's your toaster or it's your TV or your dog, then likely there's an illness involved. If it's a sort of a change in awareness, an entirely internal and personal kind of thing, that's generally less likely to be a mental illness.
But even then, to be fair, silly is sort of in the eye of the beholder. I mean, a burning bush to me seems somewhat silly as a vessel to hear
God. That would be like the toaster, right?
Right.
That would totally be the mental illness side of.
And this is a question that I've always had, Rich, is when you have a flock,
yeah,
how do you determine somebody who's being visited by God and somebody who's suffering from an illness? Or do you even make that determination?
You do, and you have to. The way I did it was, did it make sense with, this makes a lot of sense. Did it make sense with what I was hearing from God? So if his crazy met my crazy, then we could all be crazy together. But if their crazy didn't meet my crazy. And a lot of what I did, though, was just empathy and common sense. A lot of times in talking with people, knowing people, you know the answers that they're looking for.
Right.
You know the things that they're dealing with. And it's impossible to separate out what you know from what you say.
Mm-hmm.
And part of my ministry, a large part of my ministry, and people would tell you to this day they believe in God and do not question because I told them things that I couldn't know. And I never really did that. If you speak in general terms and people are in such a receptive state, they're in this place where they're hungry to hear anything from God right now, you can say something general enough and yet giving them the answer they need without being specific that they absolutely are certain they have heard from God.
Indeed. And again, this is Ask an Atheist. You can give us a call at 253-584-1480, and we will be back after this. Welcome back to Ask an Atheist. If you'd like to talk to us, it's 253-584-1480. And if you would like to, and actually we're going to go right into our topic right now, which is one of the things that you get when you're an atheist is a lot of the same arguments. We called them tropes earlier. And today we are talking about one of the most popular tropes that we've ever encountered, Pascal's Wager.
Oh, Pascal's Wager. Oh, the way I hate thee. Let's count those ways. Let's kick this sucker off by talking about who is Pascal, what's this wager. Well, first of all, Blaise Pascal was a French mathematician and philosopher who lived in the 1600s. He made an argument that said basically by believing in a God, a person would have everything to gain and nothing to lose. Let's paraphrase the basic argument.
Right.
If you believe in a God and turn out to be incorrect, you have lost nothing. But if you don't believe in God and turn out to be incorrect, you will go to hell. Therefore, it's foolish to be an atheist. That's the short of it. I think that's a load of crap.
Yes, it is.
I think the first thing I would throw out there of why is it immediately tries, and it comes from the fact that this guy was a mathematician. It makes an attempt to make a reasoned, logical, probability-based argument for the existence of God. But if you really dig under that immediate wafer-thin layer at the very top, it's entirely based on emotional fear. It relies on you being afraid of hell or some kind of eternal punishment.
Well, and his math may be good, but his givens are wrong.
Exactly.
His given is that there is a God and that there is a heaven or a hell. I mean, his givens that religion won't cost you anything. He's taking that as a given. I'd argue that his given is wrong.
Oh, I absolutely.
Something I do like to say is that in this case, he's positing that belief is a zero-cost option.
Absolutely. I mean, this is
well
this.
Said.
It's an early apologetic argument, and we've talked about Christian apologetics before, that these things don't exist to convince non-believers to become believers.
Right.
This is an internal thing. This is a way for believers to hammer down the doubts that sort of bubble up.
The idea that apologetics is a tool set that you take to the unbelievers is actually probably as new as the internet.
Yeah, it's so odd that that's why these things are so ineffective, is that they almost rely on you to be a believer in the first place. That apologetic arguments come out when the regular reasons people have for belief start to fail.
Right.
That when the there's a hole in the argument, this is their attempt to patch that up. It doesn't work on us.
Which is why when you're an atheist or an agnostic or just someone not of that faith, you get confused when somebody uses their book to defend their book, the evidence from the book to defend the beliefs in that book. And that makes sense from an apologetics perspective, because it's to bolster faith. It is not to bring evidence.
Yeah, there's an immediate assumption that someone else will recognize the authority of this book, and that this book has a sort of, without having to say it, this book is right. We don't hold to that, obviously. And I think that a really big important thing to toss out there is, why do they toss it out? The reason we're bringing it up, even though this is an apologetic argument, is, like you said, we hear this all the time.
Right.
That I would say probably about a good half of the arguments that I hear when somebody finds out I'm an atheist and they go into gunslinger mode to sort of defend their Bible is usually sort of fear of hell.
Right.
And there seems to be this real misunderstanding that I don't share that fear. I know that this is the one difference Sam and I have from Rich, is we didn't grow up in a religious environment. That it does not compute. Hell always seemed kind of like a silly thing to me.
When you're a kid, hell seems scary.
Oh, it's scary because you're thinking
detention is scary, or the deep end of the pool is scary. It's the unknown.
Absolutely. But the fact that children believe in things so literally, that I've known children, you can talk them into believing in Ewoks.
Right.
But let's see here.
Not after that miniseries.
And get back to something that Richard said earlier. This is absolutely true. If you choose theism and you're wrong, you do lose something.
Right.
And that's time. If we're someone who, generally, atheists are people who, for the most part, do not believe in an afterlife, this life here, this becomes infinitely valuable.
Yes.
It seems like if I want to have this tiny, finite time, wasting it seems like the worst thing you could possibly do, especially wasting it worrying about pleasing or appeasing somebody who doesn't exist.
Well, not just wasting time, but wasting the opportunity to be active. So many times what the religious guy is going to tell you is, wait on God to work this out for you. Pray and wait for an answer from God. And what you're losing is an opportunity to actually seize what has taken place. Much of my life, I had situations that I waited on God and as a result lost the opportunity. And I have noticed since I have become an atheist, I don't take that first approach that I'm going to pray to God and see what God does and how God works it out and God this and that. What I'm going to do is Rich is going to get active and try to fix the situation. Rich is going to find out what he can do to address the situation. And as a result, you can actively take control of things in your life. And for 43 years of my life, at 20 years of that as a preacher, I was paralyzed by situations that now I can take by the horns and take care of. And I know some religious people say, oh, that's simply not true. But if you've ever had your pastor, if you've ever said yourself, I'm going to pray for God to work this out, if that's the approach you're taking, you're not actively working out the situations in your life. You're not taking control of your life. You have, and is that a no-cost option? I think that's an expensive option. And that is not a lose-nothing option.
And you're touching on one of the things that I like from a philosophical basis about atheism is the freedom of personal responsibility.
Right.
Is that as an atheist, the buck stops here. If I make a bad decision, it's my bad decision. If I make a good decision, it's my good decision. And if you'd like to talk about that, again, this is Ask an Atheist. Our phone number is 253-584-1480. I'm Sam, and with me today is Mike and Rich, and we are talking about Pascal's Wager.
Yeah, I think there's something else liberating about atheism. One of them is that when something bad happens to you, not only do I have to take responsibility for certain things, I don't have to feel like I'm the victim of something. That
right.
If I get cancer or if I have a loved one who dies in a car accident, nobody chose to have that happen to me.
What, you mean it wasn't the will of God for your newborn baby to suddenly die and it's part of God's beautiful plan for
No,
you're not burning off karma for something 2,000 years ago?
Absolutely not. And I find the fact that people are so willing to give God a pass on stuff that if a human being did that, like if Sam, I felt that you were just too grumpy So I'm gonna give a loved one of yours cancer and have them die because I know, I just know that if you went through that experience, you would come out a better person. If somebody found out that somebody did that to them, if like they're like, okay, I'm going to inject your child with like a staph infection because I know this would make you a better parent. After that process of caring for that child, you'd be such a better parent. That person would be a psychopath.
Right.
Yeah.
So I mean,
I might be a better person, but you had to give somebody a staph infection or cancer to do it. How are they coming out ahead?
You have to think if something's that powerful and that smart and that unimaginably immense, they could come up with a better way
right.
to teach
exactly.
you. I mean, after-school specials generally come up with better ways of doing that sort of stuff. Another thing is with this omniscient God, this God would be able to see through Pascal's wager that if you're basically just hedging your bets
exactly,
and you're covering your ass, a being that can read your heart and mind isn't going to be convinced by someone who's just out to game the system. You're basically being a rules lawyer. I mean, not to mention that this is a God who, according to the scripture, demands love and worship on pain of eternal torment. This wager already presupposes a God that is willing to throw you to hell for not loving him back. Certainly, if he finds out that you're gaming his system in some way, he's gonna see right through that and toss you back down there.
Well, but isn't his system built to be gamed anyway? I mean, the whole plan is you either have eternity in hell, which is fire, which is about as hurtful as we can imagine something being. So we're going to put you in the most painful situation we can, and it never ends, and you never have hope for it ending, and you're going to burn and 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 burn. Or I'm going to give you the most delightful, lovely, wonderful, beyond your imagination, we can't even describe how good it is, place for you to go forever and ever and ever. And now, isn't this system already being gamed? I mean, aren't we already in right. that whole situation where, wait a minute, the only reason I'm really saying I love you and worship you and everything is to keep out of the bad place and in the good place, has nothing to do with who you are or what you are or the fact that you love me or create. All it is, I mean, it's already on the table. You know, he's already gamed his own system, I guess.
It sounds a lot like North Korea, really, where you're in this place that this person who has control over all aspects of your life tells you that he loves you, and he's got pictures of himself all over the place, and he's going to take care of you as long as you love him back. And if you don't, oh, you are going to get it then.
Well, the whole thing is gaming the system from the beginning. They're not expecting you to hold on to Pascal's wager for the whole time. They're expecting you to use Pascal's wager as a wedge to get you in the door. Then you get in the door. Then they turn on the machines. Now you're a believer. They don't expect you to. It's a conversion technique. It is not a belief, and it's not even new to Pascal. Is one of the things I learned before was that this was actually an argument that was refuted by Euripides in one of his plays. And so this is the idea of Pascal's wager is actually much older than Pascal.
Oh yeah, it is, and it also the one thing I have an issue with too is it makes this assumption that belief is a choice.
Right.
Because the minute you're actually going through this formula, you're already not believing; you're just proclaiming belief.
And
right.
Again, if I may wax philosophical, the thing that I dislike most about Pascal's wager is how it clouds you from truth. Is that once you've accepted belief on faith and not on evidence, you've now clouded your perceptions.
Exactly. The concept of, like, once you believe you're healed, you are healed. You know, it's pretty hard to twist your mind to believe something that isn't.
Right.
Absolutely. But once you get really good at twisting your mind to believe things that aren't, then you lose the ability to believe things as they are. I experienced that. I got really good at this faith game, at believing what isn't. And it messes with your mind. And you get to this place where reality becomes subjective, where reality and fact is not so important anymore.
Right.
And that's a dangerous place to be. I think they're, you know, words I don't think schizophrenic is the word I'm looking for, but there are diagnoses that fit that, where you're no longer able to grasp reality as fact.
And it becomes hard for you to talk to other people at that point, too, because if you can't even agree on a common reality, how are you going to make any kind of concession to coexist with this person?
And if you'd like to help us nail this down, This is Ask an Atheist. Our phone number is 253-584-1480, and we are talking about Pascal's Wager.
I think another big problem with Pascal's Wager is there's this assumption that this is a dichotomy. It's a false dichotomy, that the choices are basically the challenger's version of Christianity and atheism, where that really isn't. There are, in fact, thousands of religions and thousands of gods that people believe in. So which god are we talking? Are we talking about Yahweh? Are we talking about Thor, Brahma? Are we talking about Zeus, Zardoz? And even any of these multiples of religion, none of them simply say that basic belief, basic theism, is enough to attain whether it's heaven or nirvana, paradise, enlightenment, what have you.
Right.
Most of them usually require some kind of devotion, some adoptions of rituals, maybe dietary or sexual restrictions, rules, ideological beliefs. That's so much more dense, and a lot of these rules are actually tell you need to be exclusive to just this one religion. So somebody who's big on Pascal's Wager would really have to really follow this to its ultimate conclusion, be a member of every religion simultaneously, to be safe.
But what do you do when you've got religions like, you mentioned Yahweh, you've got Jesus. Jesus says, no man comes to the Father except by me. So, and then you've got Yahweh saying, there is no other God but me. So you've got this situation. How are we going to keep Yahweh happy while we're believing in Thor and while we're believing in Poseidon? And because we're going to have to believe in all of them if Pascal's Wager is going to work, right?
Yeah, and not
or at least the right one, but we can't prove who that is.
I believe that's the UU conundrum, actually.
the really funny bit, too, is like mentioning UU, Unitarian Universalists, is that even on just one of these deities, let's just say Yahweh, the God of the Bible, even the people who believe in just that one God can't come to any sort of consensus on what this God wants, what its priorities are. Clearly, a Unitarian or a member of the United Church of Christ is going to have a very different opinion than a regular viewer of the 700 Club.
Yeah. And I suppose in defense of Pascal's Wager, I'll make one. In that Pascal's time, if you weren't a part of the church, at the very least you were a social outcast. It got significantly worse after that if you were known to be a non-believer. So in that context, when we're talking about physical pain or loss of property because you're not a believer, okay, that might make sense.
The funny bit, though, is that we're not even really arguing about the next life, that you're avoiding pain in the next life. You're avoiding fire and torture in this life because the church was the authority.
Exactly.
Right? It was indistinguishable from the state.
This is a political argument, not a spiritual.
But I'd say the final problem that I have with it, and I think this is my biggest problem with Pascal's Wager, is that the people who dish it out don't take it.
Right.
That the folks, usually Christians, who toss this thing out don't take the wager themselves. They aren't simultaneously trying to die in battle so that they can go to Valhalla. They aren't trying to forsake all desire to break the cycle of samsara and achieve nirvana. They're not declaring that only Allah is God and Muhammad is his prophet. Because you can't do all of these things at once. Not well. The amount of it just seems like there's too many things that you would have to do that you would have no free time other than in the pursuit of keeping yourself out of hell.
Well, that's even true in internally in some religions. To keep all the laws all at the same time, some negotiation is required.
Oh, that's why some people say, oh, that one doesn't count anymore, but that one does.
Right.
Even if they're on the same page of the Bible.
Even on the same page of the Bible, it's, that doesn't count anymore. We don't listen to the Old Testament, except for that part. Oh, and that part, too. Oh, and that one. That one you have to take literally, but so that one's just a...
We're discussing the millennial dispensationalist reading of the Bible where you jump back and forth as necessary to achieve a certain narrative.
Oh, it's a choose-your-own-adventure book.
Right. It is.
But I would say I want to offer up an alternative to this, that you can come up with a better version of Pascal's Wager. This one I've seen attributed to Marcus Aurelius, of course, the Roman emperor.
All right.
Yeah, we're bringing the Romans.
We're in my town now.
He offered this one. Live a good life. If there are gods and they are just, then they will not care how devout you have been, but will welcome you based on the virtues by which you have lived. If there are gods but unjust, then you should not want to worship them. If there are no gods, then you will be gone and will have lived a noble life and that will live on in the memories of your loved ones. So basically, be a good person. You have nothing to lose by being a good person.
Absolutely. And people are less likely to ask you weird questions if you're a good person. Again, this is Ask an Atheist, 253-584-1480. We're talking about Pascal's Wager. Coming up is news, and we'll see you in a moment. Well, welcome back to Ask an Atheist, 253-584-1480. And before we move on, we've mentioned this a couple times, and I'll say it explicitly. You used to be a preacher, Rich.
Yes, 20 years, United Pentecostal Church, senior pastor, 10 years of a church. Up to that, I was associate pastor of a church in Marshall, Texas.
Okay. And while you were a preacher, did you ever use Pascal's Wager yourself?
I didn't do it directly as an existence of God. I honestly, until I moved to Seattle, never met someone I thought was an atheist.
Okay.
I never, the thought of someone not believing in God was not comprehensible to me. However, I used something similar. The church I was a pastor of, United Pentecostal Church, very much a lot of rules. Men had to keep their hair short. It was a sin for a woman to trim her hair. Makeup was a sin for, and when we say sin, that means go to hell. Women had to wear dresses, no pants, sleeves down to your wrists, up to your neck. I mean, a dress code that was just unbelievable. And I would use a similar version of it, saying, you know, even if all of this is not necessary, it won't hurt us to do these things. And if we get to heaven and find out we did too much, okay, so much. But if we get to heaven and find out, you know, if it took a bucket load to get there and we're a tablespoon short, we're going to wish we had done more.
It's better to overdo it than underdo it.
Exactly. So that was the way I actually used it. And of course, the fallacy of that is the same as what we've just discussed, is that when you're shooting for an unknown mark, there's no such thing as knowing if you hit that mark.
Sure. We actually have a couple calls. We should probably dive into those. This is Nick in Tacoma, and you'd like to talk to us about doubt. How are you doing today?
Hey, how you doing?
Very good.
Yeah, you guys were talking about basically all these major religions basically being based off of fear of going to hell. And one thing that I was thinking of just as I was listening was Doubting Thomas, the story of Doubting Thomas, and the whole kind of trying to discourage people from doubting what is being said in the Bible. You know, show me the holes in your hand,
right?
And that's the only way that, you know, I'm going to believe. And it's for me, even when it comes for anything like religion or political beliefs, I find that I always try and keep myself in check by always doubting my beliefs, just so that way I'm just a little bit more sure.
One of the strongest tools in the skeptical toolbox is doubt.
Oh, it's the biggest tool, and most tools are some variation of it. I think it's important for us to doubt claims that we hear, and I think it's especially important for us to doubt claims that we want to believe. I think that the more something fits into our sort of preconceived notion of the world, the more careful we have to be about just accepting it without question.
I think a very good point that Nick makes here is that religion is geared to strip away that tool from you, though, by specifically calling Thomas out for demanding to see the wounds, and for calling him out and saying, you're wrong for doing this. What the message of that is that you cannot doubt. And I think a very important point that he's making is the Bible is stripping away the tools that we have to strip it away. It's very cool because the Bible also says that the mind is enmity or the enemy of God. So your own mind, well, wait a minute, I can't use my mind to reason this out. Well, that takes away the only tool we have, as you were mentioning, is a valuable tool. But the Bible is designed in such a way that it takes that tool away from you and leaves you with what? If you can't doubt, if you can't reason, what
can
you
use? All you have is basically just the Bible to go off of, and you can't and you know, you can't use anything else.
Right.
Oh, absolutely.
That's something that I can't, you know, test and repeat things that are stated in the Bible for the most part. I mean, you know, of course, yeah, the Bible has little valuable nuggets like, you know, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, but that's basically just what it is.
It's hardly unique to the Bible, and you really
right.
and you
exactly.
have to, you have to cherry pick more than millennial dispensationalists do in order to get at that stuff.
Yeah. And again, a broken clock is right twice a day. That yeah. even having a couple nuggets of gold in there isn't enough to cover up the rest of it, which is there's not a lot of wheat for the ratio of chaff that you get in the Bible. And some of that chaff is really nasty.
I do like that we have biblical evidence of the faith versus doubt argument. that this whole atheism versus atheism and skepticism versus faith and religion is by no means new.
Right.
New atheism is roughly 3,000 years old.
I like that very much, very much. Another thing that I lost my point.
Oh, all right. Anything else, Nick?
No, that's about it. I actually have to go back to work right now. So thanks for letting me on. I love the show.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you.
All right.
You have a good day. Our next call is Alan in Florida, and he'd like to talk about gallbladders. How you doing, Alan?
Yeah. First of all, I'd like to say that when you guys were talking about believing in all gods or Pascal's wager, it reminded me from that scene from The Mummy where the mummy is about to jump the guy and he has all those necklaces around his neck.
I actually referenced that. I love that movie.
I had just come in. All right, and I'll take my answer since I'm listening with other people. But as an atheist, I wasn't sure how to react to something that happened at the hospital last week. My dad went into the emergency room. It's like 5 a.m. The doctor comes out. He tells me that my dad has an infected gallbladder. He has his gallbladder removed. My mom's there with me. And I ask him, what's the cause of the infection? And the doctor looks at me and goes, God, without missing a beat.
Wow. The doctor said that?
The doctor said that. The person who was going to be literally pulling the organs out of my father's stomach said that. And at that point, I just start staring at them. And my mom knows I'm an atheist and a science teacher. And she tries to sell the situation and then grabs me and says, oh, my son's a scientist. He wants another answer. And he's like, no, God. Or if you want a longer explanation, I'll give it to you. And she's like, you'd like it. And then he just kind of shoved us away. I got the impression that God was his stock, I don't want to talk about it answer.
The part that I find funny about this is like, don't worry about, you know, my son, he's a scientist. The doctor is supposed to be a scientist.
Exactly.
As a former
hospital chaplain, my first answer would be, I need a second opinion. Because if God is his answer, then he's going to be depending on God to fix this.
Right.
Do we have any CDC numbers on God?
I was shocked. I posted on my Facebook, you know, God is an appropriate answer as demons or the four humors as an imbalance.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Humors.
I'll take the answer offline since other people in the room want to hear what you guys are saying. But I wanted to know if you thought that angry silence was the correct answer or whether you thought that I should have said something or whether I'm still considering writing to the hospital. And I just want to say thank you guys for a great podcast every week.
Thank you very much. Yeah,
very
you
much.
Have a good day.
I would definitely write the hospital.
Oh, yeah.
I think absolutely. Number one, chaplains operate within guidelines that I'm very familiar with. Doctors have similar guidelines that they have to operate within. And number one, I would say he overstepped his bounds there. I don't think there's a real medical school in America, and when I say real, I'm not talking some of the Woo-head stuff,
right,
but a real medical where you go to and you become a doctor that would say God is the cause of this. And that is just poor medical advice and obviously needs to be, number one, reported. But number two, people need to understand that that answer just – not only is it inaccurate and we can scientifically prove what's wrong with a gallbladder.
Right. I think the secular incantation, I would like a second opinion,
yes,
was the way to go.
Yeah, and God is sort of a catch-all answer for any question, isn't it? I mean, it's basically the answer you get. It's like that word fnord. It doesn't mean anything,
right,
but you throw it in there. You can say, oh, God. Just say you don't know.
This is a gapless God of the gaps.
This is a
God of I don't have time to talk to you.
Aside from this is the fact that this doctor is talking to people that are in a vulnerable emotional state. I don't want a doctor that's going to pull this stuff out on me.
Right.
Not while I'm upset, and I'm more likely to scream at him. I don't want to scream at a doctor. I really don't, especially when I'm already you're upset about your father.
Not when he's about to operate on your dad.
Right.
Oh, that's a bad place to be.
Yeah, can you tag somebody in? I mean,
absolutely. That's what I would say. We need a second opinion here, preferably someone else who can do the surgery.
Yeah.
Because that is a bad answer, and the fact that a doctor thinks he can pass that off on you that's just unacceptable.
Yeah, and if he thinks that God's a cause, I'm almost afraid he's going to think God is a cure.
Oh,
yeah,
that's a good point.
He's going to go, it's like, okay, why are you taking a priest into the operating room?
Yeah. I mean, this is not an excuse to never have a religious doctor. I know doctors, many of them believe in things, but what they do at church and what they do in the OR are separate things, and they approach them separately, and they're very good doctors. But when somebody is in the context of a caregiver, of a medical professional, and they say God as an answer for something about the gallbladder, which we know pretty well, that's a scary situation to be in Florida. We didn't ask him how far north he is thereby this, how far south he is.
Is that, they say, the farther north you are, the farther south you've gone?
This is something we were learning about Florida as we do the show.
Wow.
So,
well, you know, I did have a doctor that, and some patients that insisted I pray for the doctor's hands before surgery, and actually, you know, did that and prayed over the doctor's hands. And in one particular doctor, one particular situation, I was not the one who prayed over his hands, but I knew the doctor and knew that he would not do surgery without having the chaplain on duty pray over his hands before surgery. He made a mistake in surgery, and a woman died.
Oh, nobody sued you, though, did they?
He did get sued, but he made a settlement, an out-of-court settlement, and in terms with his malpractice insurance. But his answer simply was that it must have been God's will for this young woman, who was, I believe, 30 at the time, to die because his hands had been prayed for. He was anointed by God, and he was doing God's will.
This seems like that lack of responsibility you mentioned before. It's like, it wasn't me, it was God. God wanted this. There's nothing I can do. So
yeah.
It seems like at that point you don't have to accept responsibility for anything you do, because if you screw up, you can simply go pass the buck.
Yeah.
That this was God's will, and are you going to argue with God?
Doesn't really work in the courtroom, though.
Yeah, not so much. You can't. It's not like a John Denver movie where you can actually call God to the stand.
Yeah. Again, this is Ask an Atheist. If you'd like to communicate with us, you can actually send us an email at askanatheist.tv. Click on the big red button. Or if you'd like to leave us a voicemail, we actually have a phone number. That's 206-420-0997. As we've mentioned before, you're an ex-preacher.
Yes.
And you've been telling a story about your transition from being a preacher to being an atheist and being with us and some other organizations. And we should probably talk about that a little bit.
It's called Living After Faith, and you can find it at livingafterfaith.com. You can go to iTunes or the Zune and search Living After Faith. And right now, if you key in Living After Faith in Google, we're the first dozen or so hits that you'll find. And what Living After Faith is about is taking people from that place, people who have already decided to be atheists, but they're dealing with the fallout from it, when your community disappears, when your family disappears, when all of a sudden you have to reset your whole brain, heart, mind, the whole connection, and figure out, where do I go from here? Who am I? Where do I fit in? What gives life meaning now? You know, something catastrophic probably had to happen for you to reach the place that you say, I can't believe in God anymore.
Yeah.
So how do I recover from that? How do I recover as a person and come back into mainstream? And it's been a hard ride for me. It's been 5 years. It involved suicidal tendencies. It involved post-traumatic stress disorder, treatment and therapy for that. But I have come through, and life is awesome, and I love the life that I'm living now. I'm happier than I've ever been in my life. And what we're trying to do is help people realize, number one, you can get there.
You can.
Once religion is loosed from your life, at first you feel so empty, so devoid, so stripped, so naked, so robbed, so lied to, so many things. But you can come to a place. It's hard, but you can come to a place. Right now there are 9 people that I could show you emails from that are now receiving therapy that weren't until they heard me tell my story.
Fantastic.
Because the story has things, common threads, and they realize, wait, I didn't realize that was a symptom, that I'm sick and need help.
Yeah.
And it's kind of rewarding to see that in just 12 weeks, we have actually – I'm not praying for these people. I'm actually doing something more important than that. I'm telling them, get to a therapist. Here's some questions you want to ask to see if it's the kind of therapist you want to go to. And they're getting real help.
It is a fantastic story. It is an incredible story. I invite everybody to go listen to it at Living After Faith.
Living After Faith.
LivingAfterFaith.com. .com. Yes. Oh, okay, great.
I just also want to say that how much I enjoy Life After Faith as well. It's a terrific podcast, and I'm somebody who didn't grow up against a religious background, and I just want to say I have such tremendous respect for everything Rich came through and not being like insane after all of that.
Yeah.
He's just this remarkably cool person, and
And he carries a nimbus of happiness everywhere he goes.
Absolutely. There is just a positive energy just shooting out of the guy.
And from someone who didn't come from a religious background, I actually find these stories, and his story in particular, very useful in sort of meeting in a central place with somebody who came from a religious background. Is there are stories that he has and other people have, which are just not in my statistical universe. I've never experienced anything like that.
If you want to say religion is as Pascal said earlier, a no-cost option or a no-cost, my story can show you, and a lot of other people's stories can show you, huge cost.
Absolutely. If you'd like to talk to us, if you'd like to talk to us about Pascal's wager, about atheism, about leaving religion, after the show, we always meet up and have some dinner. Tonight, we're having it at Doyle's Public House at 208 St. Helens Avenue in Tacoma, right at 2nd and St. Helens, and we'll be there at 5. And this has been a fantastic show.
I've enjoyed it.
A lot of fun working with you guys.
Yeah, this is not the last time you'll be hearing from Rich by any means. But and that's our show for today. My name is Sam Mulvey, and my co-host was Mike Gillis and Rich Lyons. Our call screener was the very lovely Bob Zeidensdecker. Camera was Jeremy Whitman, and our auxiliary was Beth Lehman. And
how much time do we have?
Yeah, we got some time.
So, yes, Ask an Atheist is a production of NEDM Media and recorded live at KLAY Studios in Lakewood, Washington. Thank you, and keep it godless.